Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, also author of The Weed Agency. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis to round out the week for you. We start with the good, and this one certainly has a tinge of crazy to it. This courtesy of the Washington Times. At a fundraiser in Chicago, First Lady Michelle Obama says that there is too much money in politics. And then she immediately asked for the biggest, fattest check from each donor in the room. She says, yes, there's too much money in politics. There's special interests that have too much influence. They had all that money and all that influence back in 2008 and 2012, and we still won those elections. But we need to be engaged right from the beginning. I kid you not. I'm going to be honest with you. That's what we need to do right now. We need you to write the biggest, fattest check that you can possibly write. So, Jim, no disconnect there.
Besides the fact the hypocrisy from one sentence to the next, you know, money is politics is destroying our democracy. That's why I need a lot of money from you right now. This is the good martini, Greg, because I really think we have to salute Michelle Obama. Finally, she has found something in America that she wants to see bigger and fatter. All of us have to get slimmer, but her, you know, the DNC bank account is allowed to get bigger and fatter and all that kind of stuff. You know, interesting. Look, the fact that they're being so shameless about the fundraising at a traditionally kind of, you know, slow part of the year indicates to me that certainly they're not overconfident going into this. You kind of wonder if they're seeing things in the poll, in the private polling numbers that mirror what we see in the public polling numbers, indicating an ominous outlook for Democrats. If the political atmosphere is bad enough, you kind of wonder if really donations are going to make that much of a difference. It was also interesting, there was a San Francisco Chronicle story the other day saying that donor fatigue was starting to set in amongst Democrats. True that, like, this was like his last week, this week was like his like 17th or 18th trip to the Bay Area for a fundraiser. And he's only been president like 5.5 years. So you run the numbers, that's like, you know, about, you know, 4 year, which means about once every 3 months. You know, if you're a wealthy San Francisco liberal, you get hit up for money like once every 3 months, and the president is in town personally to do it to you. So it's kind of a bizarre set of circumstances. I think if you're a Democrat, and on the one hand, it's good to have money, sure, but they sure as heck are acting like they're desperately needing it, coupled with the fact this is the only thing the president really seems to be all that good at.
Exactly. And it's also fun that she doesn't believe that special interest money played any role whatsoever in her husband winning in 2000.
Yeah, well, yeah, her money's not special, you know.
All right. Well, while the president is off fundraising and doing some other things, there are some bad things happening in the world and at home, as it turns out. And I think most people are figuring that out. On the panel, a section of Special Report with Brett Baer last night on the Fox News Channel, he was going over some of the numbers that the president is getting in the latest Fox News opinion poll. Let's just say they're not good. Most of his approval ratings, depending on the issue, are somewhere in the 30s. They were specifically talking about the president's handling of Ukraine. I think 75% of the people asked said that Vladimir Putin had the upper hand. 14% somehow thought Obama had the upper hand. Then Brett Baer threw it to Charles Krauthammer, who gave this rosy picture of where we stand on the world stage right now.
I think there's a general perception the world is going to hell, and the president's out there playing golf. There's a disconnect here. That doesn't mean people want to go to war in Ukraine. So I'm not at all surprised people say, do you want to be involved? Of course not. Nobody wants to be involved, particularly if you have a president who doesn't go out there and make the case for it. Why would anybody decide to get involved? And of course, when the president is inactive, as he is now on this issue, has done nothing of substance, they say, well, what do you want to do? Go to war? Send troops into Ukraine? Whereas, as Joan indicates, the other policies, between nothing and war, there is a huge territory.
We're contractually obligated to point out that Jonah is Jonah Goldberg of National Review, he and Krauthammer both made the point that there are other things you could do. You could give some weaponry to the Ukrainians. You could give them jamming signals for their planes, which would seem to be rather helpful to avoid being struck by missiles fired from the ground. So not exactly a rosy picture, but a pretty accurate one, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, this is about as depressed as we've heard Charles Krauthammer sound. He's not roses and sunshine kind of guy to begin with, but I think that he's in the mood that I think a lot of folks on the right, and even, you know, in the center, you listen to the Ron Fourniers of the world. Look, we've got a lot of big problems going on overseas that a lot of the American public would rather ignore, and it's hard to begrudge the American public having that perspective. But the flip side of it is that not interacting with it doesn't mean it gets any better. We can put it out of our minds, but the consequences are real. And what's really fascinating is the president just doesn't want to deal with this. And this is, we talked in that last martini about how much fundraising he's doing. Krauthammer puts out in his column today, you can find on National Review Online, he basically says, you know, is it mentally checked out, as I've been, you know, arguing for a while? He's like, yeah, maybe. He also kind of says that Obama often likes to invoke the arc of history, you know, bends toward justice or something like that. And the idea that in time, all of these problems get solved. In eventually, all of these brutal acts don't work for the people doing the brutal acts. They stir an opposite reaction and it kind of blows up in their face. And you could say, well, you know, by giving the missiles to the Russian separatists, the resulting shooting down of the passenger plane, world scorn has been heaped on Putin. And so, well, that's great, but Putin doesn't care about world scorn. And, you know, Putin is, you know, he's not immortal. You know, we'll deal with him at some point. You know, at some point, the reign of Putin will come to an end. But the question is how much damage gets done in the meantime and how many people die and how many people get oppressed and sucked back into the orbit of Russian control. And, you know, like in the meantime, between, you know, ultimate justice, really bad things can happen. And you don't get to check out of them because you're fairly confident that in the long run, everything will be okay. If you let me invoke you, it was either Keynes or Hayek who said, in the long run, we're all dead. Yes, technically, all these problems get solved eventually. But yeah, this seems like a very strange disengagement. I think it's actually a little bit more of just, he just doesn't know what to do. He knows how to go after Mitt Romney, and he doesn't have to go after, he knows how to go after John McCain and Sarah Palin, you know. But when it comes to a foreign opponent that can't be dealt with in a clean, quick, you know, commando operation like the Bin Laden raid, I don't think he knows what to do, and I don't think he likes any of the options being put forth in front of him. So his attitude is, you know, much like in Syria, stop talking about it and hope the issue goes away. And, you know, oh, by the way, it's been the bloodiest month in Syria since the beginning of the Civil War.
Whatever the issue on the foreign stage, and many at home, it's not good across the board. So let's go to one that potentially has a streak of good news in it. And our good martini earlier in this week was the 3-judge panel from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals saying that, yes, in fact, the language is very clear in the Affordable Care Act that only subsidies obtained through state exchanges are legal. Now, those gotten through the federal exchange at healthcare.gov, not considered legal. Another appeals court the very same day said the opposite, and so ultimately this will go to the full D.C. Circuit, and many people believe the U.S. Supreme Court. But a little shot in the arm for those who believe the language is pretty darn clear is this guy Jonathan Gruber, who on behalf of the administration was pitching the details of the Affordable Care Act in 2012, and here's what he had to say in slightly confusing fashion.
In the law, it says if the states don't provide them, the federal backstop will. The federal government has been sort of slow in putting out its backstop, I think partly because they want to sort of squeeze the states to do it. I think what's important to remember politically about this is if you're a state and you don't set up an exchange, that means your citizens don't get their tax credits. But your citizens still pay the taxes that support this bill. So you're essentially saying your citizens, you're going to pay all the taxes to help all the other states in the country.
Well, Democrats aren't liking that comment coming out. So in a clarification statement, Gruber says, I honestly don't remember why I said that. I was speaking off the cuff. It was just a mistake. People make mistakes. Congress made a mistake drafting the law, and I made a mistake talking about it. And now here's the best part of all. There was never any intention to literally withhold money, to withhold tax credits from the states that didn't take that step. That's clear in the intent of the law. And if you talk to anybody who worked on the law, my subsequent statement was just a speako, you know, like a typo.
Well, I think we now have a new word he's invented, speako. A couple of interesting thoughts. One is, look, ultimately, the attitude of most Democrats since the law was passed has been do whatever you, you know, hand waving and to say, do whatever you got to do to make sure it works. We'll worry about the details later. We don't really care what the text says. We don't even really care. You know, much. There are a couple of lawmakers who said they didn't even read the bill. We like to make fun of Nancy Pelosi for if you, you know, we have to pass the bill so you can see what's in it. And clearly they didn't know what was in it either. So now they're basically saying, look, we need to give tax, you know, benefits to people who aren't in state exchanges, even though the way it was written is very clearly you only get the tax benefit if you're in a state that has the exchange, because they really, really wanted states to set up their own exchanges. Now, as we saw in Maryland and Minnesota and Hawaii and Oregon, some states just completely fell flat on their faces in this task, drastically overestimating the competency of administrators and contractors in these states. So now they kind of need to kind of erase this from history and say, no, no, anybody who wants can get these tax benefits. Any state doesn't really matter. Except, you know, Gruber said it way back when, and now he's got to say, he's got to denounce the 2012 version of himself, much like Charlie Crist running against his own past legislation. he's got to basically insist, who are you going to believe, me or your lion eyes? What I said then, I totally didn't mean. He misspoke, even though you can tell from that soundbite, it's not a small bit. It's a lengthy explanation. He's totally convinced what he's saying, and now it's proven inconvenient to him. Now, I would just kind of point out that I think we can simply say we've had enough of Gruber. And this is a guy who comes from a very troublesome family, Greg. back in the late 80s, his brother Hans took over Nakatomi Tower and caused a big problem out there in L.A. And then in the mid-90s, his older brother Simon did all kinds of terrible things in New York, at least from the documentary series Die Hard that I know of and stuff like that. There's a line from one of the movies where an intelligence guy says to John McClane, "Does the name Gruber mean anything to you?" And he has this ominous look on his face. And I think that's very appropriate for us, a response for us to have now that we see what this Gruber has done to the U.S. healthcare system.
You want to say it or you want me to say it? Yippee-ki-yay!
Well, see, we got to go on, close the week on a nice happy note, Greg.
There yeah. you go. Anytime you can throw Die Hard into the mix, we're doing well.
There you go.
Jim, have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend. I will see you Tuesday, Greg.
Sounds good. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.